You may proceed. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Thomas Leland. I'm from the law firm of Lathrop & Gage. My registration number is 35631, and I represent the appellant Rocky Mountain Natural Gas LLC in this appeal. I have 4 points that I'd like to make at oral argument today. The first point is that the contract in this case is not invalid under the rule of Normandy Estates case or La Plata or the Cherry Creek Aviation case. In all of those cases, there was a wholesale failure to enact the contract through an ordinance, and the court would not do that because to do so would impinge on elected officials and legislative process. In contrast, what we have here is a fully authorized contract, which is expressly permitted by the statute, with one single partially unenforceable term. And so the contract, and we cited to you the town of Highlands case, the town of Highlands case from New York, which was the most on-point case that we could find in the entire country. And in that case, which is on all fours with this case, the contract was an otherwise authorized, enforceable contract to get power for the city. The only term of the contract which was unenforceable was its length. The contract called for a term so long as the district exists, and the statute said it has to be limited to 4 years.
Mr. Leland, isn't that a difference from this case in that the town of Highlands didn't have a specific unauthorized term, but rather a term which might have been unauthorized depending on how long the district existed?
That's true, Your Honor, that under the contract it was an open end, that it could have gone on for that long. Nonetheless, under the terms of the contract, it was not limited to 4 years, and the trial court in that case did exactly what the trial court did in this case, was through the whole thing.
I guess my problem is, why shouldn't we look at Town of Highlands as more of an ambiguous term, which was reformed to a legal term, rather than a specific illegal term, which you're asking us to reform? I can see a difference. Maybe there is no difference, but...
Your Honor, with respect, I don't see a difference because, again, what we are talking about is a length of years. That the contract as written was open-ended. It could have gone on forever, so long as the district exists. And the statute said thou must only contract for a 40-year term. In essence, it is the same thing here, although, of course, here we have a 20-year term, 240 months of the lease, and the statute specifically empowers them to enter into leases of this type for terms of 3 years or less. So the rule, and as set forth in the Supreme Court of Tennessee case that we cited, is however you get there, when you're contracting with a municipality, a government entity, or a special district under Colorado law, they cannot avoid liability for their own breach of contract by saying that we ourselves have exceeded our authority, that we made a mistake, and therefore we can scoot away scot-free after we have induced considerable reliance. And as we set forth in our briefs, we're talking about millions of dollars spent here.
Let me ask you this.
Yes.
The invalid portion of this agreement, would you characterize it as incidental or as a primary purpose of this agreement? I'm talking about the 37 out of 4 years.
You mean in the 17 out of 20 years in our contract?
And then they have the option to...
Well, what I would say is this, Your Honor, is there's no denying that they entered into a contract for 240 months. That's what it says in the contract. So it is a term of the contract. The purpose was to get a compressor station built as quickly as possible because, as we said in our briefs, our client is a public utility and has public service obligations to deliver the gas up to Aspen, and that's ultimately what this case is all about. However, and this sort of brings me to my second point, the parties were very prudent in this contract. Yes, it's for 240 months, but they made sure to include a savings clause that says if any part of this contract is void or is unenforceable or is inconsistent with Colorado law, the court is directed to enforce the remaining parts, provisions, or portions thereof. In our reading, any part means any part. And 3 years is a part of 17 years. And so
is seven, so is nine, so is 11. I mean, The point is, if you sever the term of the contract, there's no term left. If you sever that provision that sets forth the term of the contract, there's no term left. If you sever a portion that says you shall, you know, do an inspection or something, and you can't do that, fine, you just do the contract without the inspection. But this is very different. If you sever the term, there's no time period left in the contract. You say you want it to be 3 years, but there's nothing that says it should be 3 years in the contract. I know the statute might have allowed a three-year contract, but that's not what the contract says. Here's what I'm getting at. I don't think it's a question of severability. I think what you're really asking us to do here is to order reformation of the contract, change the term to a period of time that would comply with the statute, which is really, to me, reformation, not a separate term.
Well, and I understand, I think that's a great point. And whether you get there overall, whether you get there by enforcing it under a rule like Town of Highlands or the utilities cases, where they said, when you're a statutory official, it's enforced to the power that they have the contract. Or whether it's reformation, which is an equitable remedy, which could either be imposed under a theory of equitable estoppel, or it could be imposed under the rule of Normandy Estates. Or if you say the parties intended under the severability clause, that the contract be enforced to CMC's full authority to enter it, the end result is going to be the same. They clearly had the power to contract for 3 years.
Well, but we're splitting some legal hairs here. It seems to me, to sever on the one hand, to reform on the other hand, if we're reforming the contract, aren't we rewriting the contract for the parties?
Your Honor, again, to go back to the severability clause, when the parties intend that the court rewrite the contract to make it enforceable, then yes, the court is empowered to rewrite the contract. And that, in our opinion, is what that severability clause says. It's a lot like, I think it was the Capital Advisors case from last year that Judge Boras authored. In that case, there was no severability clause. But the court made no findings at all about what the party's intent was.
Well,
on severability.
In capital value, though, there were like three different promises. There was a promise to do this for consideration, a promise to do this for consideration, et cetera, et cetera. And so it was different from taking out one of the promises and leaving two promises than to change a term of years.
Understood and agreed. However, in Capital Advisors, there was no severability clause where at least the parties had evidence and intent for the contract to be enforced to the extent that it was consistent with Colorado law. So while I agree with you, the promises in that case could be more easily divided, in this case, we've got plain contract language that at least suggests that these parties intended that if there's anything wrong here, that if we overstepped our bounds in any way, we still have a binding contract.
But how are we to say that, what is the evidence that CMC, when called that, intended to contract for a period of 3 years? I understand that your client is willing to take 3 years, or was at least at the time of the briefs. But what's the evidence that CMC would be willing to live with a three-year term? It asked for a 20-year term.
Well,
admittedly, it couldn't, but it asked for a 20-year term. And maybe it doesn't want to go to the trouble of having a compressor station put on its ground and then taken away in 3 years.
Maybe it wouldn't, but we will never know because we never got there. The court ruled as a matter of law without holding a hearing, without making factual findings. We think under the rule of Capital Value Advisors, at the very least, there must be a factual determination of the party's intent as to whether it would be severable. We would have looked at and talked about in a hearing or evidentiary proceeding things like the fact that they've been entering into 30, 40, 50-year deals for the last 20 years. Using the same lawyer that helped write this contract. That this is business as usual for CMC. In fact, it goes to really the third point I wanted to make, which was on equitable estoppel. And you can get here on this case to enforce it for a 20-year term, in our opinion, if the court had made factual findings and taken evidence on whether it was appropriate under these circumstances to stop CMC from arguing that the lease was completely null and void based on its term.
Well, did the court not make a finding, though, that the return of the rental payment satisfied the equitable considerations?
That goes to the Normandy Estates point, which is if you throw the whole contract out and you say, nope, there never was any contract here at all, under Normandy Estates in the La Plata case, you still have to craft an equitable remedy. And all that the court did as far as that goes is said, well, they got the money back, and I find the absence of any other relief not to be grossly inequitable. That is the sum total of the findings that were made in that point.
Well, counsel, in terms of equitable relief, what are the benefits of the agreement that RMG believes it's entitled to, that it has not been fully compensated?
Well, we think that under the La Plata case, RMNG is entitled to the benefit of its bargain, to get what it contracted for. Now, you know, the truth is that because they're a public utility and they had to get those compressor stations in, they had to rush in and get another parcel for which they paid triple to build these compressor stations, because they had to purchase, in reliance on CMC's actions and promises, custom-made compressors that are about $1.5 million apiece, and those things have to be located at a specific place along the pipeline. So once they breached, and since winter is coming up in Aspen, they had to go off, get an adjoining piece of land right next to the lease site for triple the cost. This is the kind of evidence that had the district court held a hearing and made findings either on intent behind the severability clause or on whether or not CMC should have been equitably stopped from arguing the invalidity of the contract, that RMNG would have put on in evidence. I see I have about a little less than 4 minutes left. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Okay, counsel, thank you. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and thank you for granting CMC Colorado Mountain College's request for oral argument today in this case. My name is John Sullivan of the firm of Sullivan Green CV, registration number 17069. With me at council table is my law partner, Barbara Green, registration number 15022. In the proceedings below, I think the court's aware that Judge Boyd actually entered two orders granting summary judgment in this case. The first of these orders was entered on August 7th, 2012. That order is not the subject of this appeal, but it's important for several reasons, the principal of which is that he found that for purposes of this litigation, CMC is a public entity. Its essential purpose is public education. And that is important because there's a legal consequence that flows from that kind of determination. And that consequence is that when a party enters into a contract with a public entity, CMC is a like a municipality according to 2371.120, the party entering into the contract with the municipality is charged with knowledge of the statutory limitations that circumscribe the municipality's ability to enter into a contract. And it is basically, it's their obligation to make sure the municipality does the right thing. Here, that means that the plaintiff, not CMC, was the party obligated to make sure there was compliance with the statute. As the court has recognized, that didn't occur here. Judge Boyd recognized that because we have a 20-year initial lease term instead of the 3 years permitted by the statute. The purpose of having the private party be responsible for the compliance with the statute, which, by the way, must be strictly construed, is to protect the taxpayer, to encourage citizen involvement. This is quoted in the Normandy Estates case. And to protect the taxpayer against improvident use of tax revenue, to ensure disclosure of public spending and prudence and thrift by those elected to direct the expenditures of public funds. I would point out that the board in this case of CMC is a group of 7 elected officials, trustees. They are elected to 4-year terms. I may have that wrong, but they are responsible under 2371, 122, 1 D and E for dispositions. It's part of their group of powers to look at dispositions of public property.
Well, counsel, let me ask you this. did CMC have the authority to contract with RMNG for 3 years?
Did it have the authority? Yes, provided it made a finding that the property at issue was not immediately needed for the purposes of the college. It's undisputed that that never occurred in this case. We argue about whether or not the college employees had the authority to enter into a lease, but there's no finding by the board.
Because I was looking at the Iowa case that you cited in your brief, and there they said that the board did not have the authority to contract with Miller without first fulfilling the statutory requirements. Here, though, it sounds like CMC did have the authority to enter into a contract up to 3 years.
A short-term lease.
Okay, so you don't dispute that part of it? You just dispute the length of the term of the contract being up to 20 years.
Well, the way we have argued this statute should be interpreted, there's two parts to it. One, the lease can't be more than 3 years. Two, there must be a finding made that the property is not immediately needed for the college's purposes. We derive that language from the preceding subsection, which states no finding is necessary if the property is conveyed to a state agency or state government institution. And that makes some sense from a public policy standpoint, because the benefit of owning this property remains with the state of Colorado.
And let me try this a different way, because I'm just trying to get my hands around this. But I'll need to use a hypothetical. Suppose that we have the same agreement, but it's for 3 years, and the board had not approved it. Do we have a contract in this case?
No.
Okay, and why?
Because there was no finding made that the property was not immediately needed for college purposes. The property was being used as part of CMC Spring Valley campus as open space. This is why there was such an uproar from people when they realized it was going to be converted. The PUD was going to be amended to basically allow an industrial use on what had been open space since it was donated to the college. Did that answer the question?
Yes, thank you.
So I guess I have a question about Normandy Estates. Under the equitable principles in that line of cases, how is it not fair to also compensate the company for the several million dollars that they spent on customized equipment?
There's a couple of responses that I have, Judge Boris. First, it is legally and logically inconsistent to compensate someone with monetary damages for breach of a contract that is void in the first place. The second reason, and the Normandy Estates case, the La Plata Medical Associates case, recognize that. The second reason for that is Normandy Estates is a rule, limited to the facts before the Normandy Estates court in 1976. And those facts were that we had a special district that had entered into an agreement that later was determined to be void to purchase property improved by a recreational center and a swimming pool. It then not only declared the contract void when the second payment came due, it demanded reimbursement for the first payment made under the void contract. Those are the facts and circumstances that Normandy Estate says, we're just not going to have this rule where, this is where they get into the unduly harsh kind of analysis. In their briefs, Rocky Mountain Natural Gas interprets the words fully compensating in Normandy Estates and the La Plata Medical Associates case in a way that would expand the Normandy Estates exception, allow it monetary damages essentially. And that's not what the Normandy Estates exception stands for. None of the cases relied on it had those kinds of facts. The Normandy Estates uses this Latin word in specie, which according to Black's Law Dictionary means specific or specifically. It would mean a thing that retains its distinction as an individual among a certain class of properties. And in Normandy Estates, there was the swimming pool and the recreational facilities. In Chapman, the U.S. Supreme Court case that Normandy Estates relied on, it was a basically land and improvements that the county used as a poorhouse. In the city of Lawton, Oklahoma case that is cited in Normandy Estates, it was water mains that were installed in the city by a private contractor. In La Plata County, it was a medical office building. And it's important to note that in La Plata County, the trial court deliberately fashioned its remedy so that it only talked about the value of the property, the $1,140,000. That was the appraised value of the property at the time that the trial court ruled. The opposing parties wanted, they basically wanted the whole enchilada, which was $2.825 million. But if you look at the appellate Court of Appeals opinion in that case, they talk about how the trial court could not make that kind of award against the hospital district on a void contract because, one, the property wasn't worth $2.825 million as it was 7 years earlier, and two, it would in essence be enforcing the void contract if it awarded a deficiency judgment. So La Plata Associates did exactly what Normandy Estates did. It gave the public entity the choice of return the property or pay the value of the property. I also want to say that these words fully compensating are not an invitation. They were not intended to be an invitation to a court to fashion a monetary damages remedy based on equitable estoppel or some other non-contract claim. 22 years after Normandy Estates, this court in the Cherry Creek Aviation versus City of Steamboat Springs expressly denied these types of claims, monetary damages on these types of claims, on the basis that Cherry Creek, the plaintiff, could not identify a specific piece of property that the City of Steamboat Springs was retaining and therefore being unjustly enriched by the value of that piece of property. No court has expanded the limited remedy recognized in Normandy Estates since Cherry Creek Aviation. Most recently, this court in Todd Creek Village Metropolitan District, which was a 2013 opinion, characterized the Normandy Estates opinion as basically providing for an equitable remedy when there's a situation with an unenforceable contract with a municipal corporation and the municipality has not paid for the property. Then the person supplying the property may be entitled to some kind of equitable relief. Here, the money that was paid to CMC was refunded probably the day before or the day after the lawsuit was filed, because CMC recognized it can't simply declare a contract void and then retain the money it had received under the contract.
Mr. Sullivan, I want to switch gears one more time. I want to go back to the severability issue because I don't think we've asked you about that yet. Mr. Leland points out that there's a savings clause in the lease that says if any part of this lease is in conflict with the law of the state, of the validity of the remaining provisions or portions hereof shall not be affected. Now, I know that there's an argument out there that you don't want the court to rewriting contracts, and we don't want to rewrite them either, but it looks like the parties themselves have said, of course, this is what we want you to do if part of it is invalid. We want you to make it so that the part that is valid remains. What's wrong with that opinion?
Because a lease of real property is, the term is the lease. We cited an old case, Sears v. Smith, for that proposition. That's what we were trying to convey, that the term is the lease. And Judge Boyd recognized that he could not rewrite the terms of the lease because he'd basically be substituting a term for something that the parties didn't agree upon. And in the process of doing that, he'd be rewriting the contract contrary to the radiology professionals case, which prohibits that sort of a contract lease rewrite. And so you know, in this situation, to enforce the lease for 3 years would also be inconsistent. It's not only not what the parties intended, because they obviously intended a long-term relationship, it would be recognizing a claim for monetary damages, which would be contrary to the Normandy Estates remedy.
Why isn't it just a reformation of the contract, which courts do from time to time?
Because the reformation of the contract means there was some sort of a mistake, either a mutual mistake or some kind of...
Somebody made a mistake by not looking at the statute.
Well, yes, and the mistake was discovered after the fact, obviously. And so but it doesn't alter the fact that the intent of the parties was not to enter into a three-year lease.
How do we know that? And Mr. Leland made the point I asked, how do we know that CMC would not have entered into a three-year deal if someone had looked at the statute and saw that was the limit? Or they would have said, we'll enter into a series of three-year deals.
Well, the issue is, what would the parties have intended? And it's sort of like a court engaging in what speculation as to what the parties would have intended. The lease says what it says, and the capital value advisor's case is not, that type of a severability issue is not present here. In that case, there were three discrete provisions, one of which was commission for getting sale of a minority interest, another was getting sale of a majority interest, and the third was getting debt financing. The first two were found to have violated the statute and declared void. But the third one, for getting debt financing, was never really looked at. And the court, that was the provision the court wanted to sever from the other two void provisions. Here we're not severing anything. We are literally rewriting the contract from a 20-year lease to a three-year lease. At least that's what the plaintiff is suggesting. He's also said that we've already secured additional property. So in so many words, what they're saying is we want a monetary damages remedy, which is not what Normandy Estates authorizes.
Counselor, time is up. Thank
yes,
you
it
for
is.
The argument.
Thank you.
I think you have some time left, Mr. Williams. Oh. 3 minutes and 45 seconds.
That's not too bad.
That's pretty good.
Thank you, Your Honors. I would like to make four quick points in rebuttal to Mr. Sullivan's remarks. The first is that, yes, he is right. We are not appealing the specific performance issue that Judge Boyd denied. But it is important because, as we know, the usual remedy for breach of a lease of this type is specific performance, because damages are hard to calculate in these instances. In this case, we didn't have the option to file an appeal on specific performance because the case was ongoing and we had to get these compressors built. The reason it's important is this, because when you look at the denial of specific performance, the regular remedy, and then the denial of any damages whatsoever, either whether it's a valid contract, a reformed contract, or an equitable remedy under Normandy Estates, the effect is the same. The Colorado Mountain Junior College walks away completely immunized from any liability whatsoever for their rather outrageous breach in this case. And the substantial reliance and substantial money that my client spent dealing with their president, with their director of contracts, and with their 20-year lawyer on this lease. And so I agree with Mr. Sullivan, it's important to know that, but that is one of the reasons why this case cries out for some sort of equitable remedy. The second point I'd like to make is about Mr. Sullivan's point on findings, and Judge Vermont, you were right on this point, which is, if it was a three-year deal, didn't you have the authority to enter into this contract? The answer is yes. Under the law of this case, as we pointed out in our briefing, the issue of whether or not there were supposed to be findings made that the property was not immediately needed was extensively briefed before the judge. And in fact, he made a specific finding that whether there was authority to enter into the contract and what findings must have been made could not be granted on summary judgment because there were issues of fact. And so that was specifically denied by the judge. In fact, we have an affidavit, and remember, we were the non-movement on summary judgment, so all the inferences get taken in our favor. We had an affidavit from the president of the Board of Trustees at the time this contract was being negotiated that said under oath, I knew about the contract, the board knew about the contract, it was an authorized contract, and we approved the contract. So if it was for a three-year term under the procedural posture of this case, the answer is absolutely yes. They had the authority to enter into the deal. The third point I'd like to make deals very quickly with Cherry Creek Aviation. And we submitted supplemental authorities on this point. I just want to make sure that I talk about it real quickly. Cherry Creek Aviation, the basis of that case was the setup and the question on whether or not operating the municipal airport was a governmental function versus a proprietary function. And you heard Mr. Sullivan talk a lot about how the board of the trustees is elected and all of that stuff, and that's all true. But there is a substantive difference between tort law under the Governmental Immunities Act and contract law. This is a contracts case. The fact that they are a public entity under the Colorado Governmental Immunities Act has no bearing on what remedies may enter against them when they act in their proprietary capacity. And all that means is that they are acting on their own behalf. They're in the marketplace to make money for the school. And there is no dispute that this lease here was about making money for CMC. So Cherry Creek Aviation depended on that. Had they found the governmental function, had it been proprietary, it would have gone the other way. And I see that I'm out of time.
Thank you, Council. Council, thank you for your arguments. The case will stand submitted and an opinion will issue in due course.